Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome back to another episode of the 90th Percentile. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. Alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Matt Pajak of Loden Sports. Matt, how's it going today? We've got another guest this week, man. Big guest coming up.
Oh, it's going excellent. And I'm very excited about this one. I know the NFL Combine was last week, and we've got Brian Hawkins on. He's a football guy. Which is a first for the 90th percentile. And I've followed him for a while on Twitter, and I've really appreciated his attention to detail, especially on testing protocols when it comes to football combine testing. He's had a lot to say around the combine, part of that discussion, but then also on the amateur side and, you know, some of the things that he's doing with the combines that he's setting up, to get, legitimate timing for these players. Because as someone who's done it for a while in baseball, we run into some of the same things where, if the procedures aren't right, then you can't really trust the timing. And there aren't a whole lot of people out there that are really diving into and paying attention to the exactness of the times. They just, they buy into whatever they're told. Hey, you ran a, in football, it'd be, hey, you ran a 4.4. It's like, oh, you didn't really run a 4.4. It's like, In baseball, it's like, you ran a 6.360. It's like, you didn't really run a 6.3, So anyway, that just as a little bit of an intro. Brian, thanks for joining us. I do want you to kind of give us a little bit of your background, how you kind of got into the space that you're in, what exactly you do. I know you wear a couple different hats, and then, kind of how you've gotten to this point.
Yeah, thanks so much for, inviting me on. As you alluded to, this is a topic that is not really discussed enough. I'll kind of get briefly into my background without, taking up too much time. My current role is I am the National Scouting Director for NextGen Prospect. Our software was created by a former head football coach up in Fairport, New York, named Mark Vitacor, who I'm very close with. Met him probably back in about 2018. The software is kind of well known because Jim Nagy at the Senior Bowl uses our software. So as you see him build his board and his kind of player cards, that's NextGen software. I don't really talk about that much. People put the connection together, but I am in charge of managing our national big board. We probably have about 6,000 or 7,000 high school players on it currently right now. I help with kind of the creation and modification of our grading scale. And we have a team of about 4 or 5 regional scouts that are constantly identifying prospects, collecting as accurate as information as we can on, height, weight, speed. And we have a lot of clients, Power 5 schools like Florida State, Syracuse, LSU. And I won't, go too deep into that because that's not really the topic of what we're going to be discussing. But yeah, and then on top of that, I do my own combine showcase series called the Classic Series, and it's kind of evolved over the years. I've been doing timing probably and studying timing for years, maybe 10 years or so. I didn't start doing timing myself as a practitioner. There's a difference between studying it and then actually going out in the field and timing athletes. Started doing that several years ago as I started kind of digging into track and field, because that is, as people follow me on X, formerly Twitter, that's the highest standard of timing, which I'll get into. I also, you know, as I spoke before we started, you know, recording the pod, I've worked as an NFL consultant for a number of teams. I still do that, where I work on special projects. You know, one, people ask, well, what exactly does a consultant do? Just about anything. One project in particular that I worked on was timeout tendencies. It's not the most exciting thing to study, but I would literally track, as teams are playing opponents, the trends on when timeouts are called. And you can learn a lot from looking at when coaches like to call timeouts. Not something that fans would notice, but teams do utilize that information. And I think that's about it, man. I don't want to ramble trying to give like a synopsis of kind of what I do before we dig in. And then, you know, for back in the early 2000s, I've coached, played in college as well, was a walk-on. And yeah, I've pretty much done everything at every level of football, whether or not it's playing, coaching high school ball. I've not coached at the collegiate or pro level. Definitely don't in this day and age with NIL. I don't know if I ever want to enter into that that realm at all. But yeah, man, so that's a synopsis of kind of like what I do with football.
Yeah, it's kind of what I gathered. I mean, not to the extent that you just explained it, but from following you for the past, you know, year or so, it's just that you're involved in a lot of different things. There's a lot of different things that pique your curiosity. And you seem to be a lifelong learner, which I think is, you know, me and Jeff like surrounding ourselves with lifelong learners. So, you know, I reached out to you and you got back right away and you said you'd hop on. I was pretty excited about that. But yeah, I want to get, you know, cooking right away on the 40 time. It just, you know, look, like baseball's got the 60, and for a lot of people, the 60 is antiquated, but the 60 continues to be a staple of a showcase setting or, you know, pre-draft workout or whatever it might be. I think let's just tee this off a little bit with the 40. And how important is it, you know, I guess, at the high school level when trying to secure a collegiate scholarship? And then kind of what does the space look like right now for a high school player when they're getting their 40?
Well, let's do a little history lesson first, like on the 40. Most people don't know this. I ask this all the time, like, who invented the 40, right? Like, look at track and field. You don't have a 40-yard dash in track and field. We know there's a 50. Everything is in meters, right? Because internationally, we have our metric system that we use. But just look at track and field. You know, the 100 meters, kind of like the gold event. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're like, we've had that for decades since the Olympics like started, you know. The 40 started with legendary coach Paul Brown was trying to assess punt returns and kickoffs, right, which is a longer running distance. So it is through the sources, whether or not you're reading, you know, biographies written and you've kind of read and done some ancillary, you know, some basic research, started with him and being able to assess how fast guys could run on a punt or like kickoff. The combine, I believe, started in what, 1987, and they began getting all of these 40 times, and it's become, because of the historical data and the fact that we have all of these athletes that have been timed, that's why it's stuck around. There are some, you know, as I like to call in data, we say, you know, noise and signal, right? You get a lot of signal, you know, athletically from a 40 time. How important is it for college recruiting? Most schools, a majority of schools, have historically looked at the 40 time kind of as just like a baseline measurement of what a kid, what a position, you know, what is the range that we're looking for example, for a kid to have to run to be able to play within our program. most schools do have parameters or criteria, right? And I'm sure they have this for the 60. For example, you know, a school may have, you know, a kid, a running back has to run between, you know, at the very slowest, they have to be at a 4.8 or below, because a 4.7 for a running back, there's plenty of NFL running backs that run 4.7. So how important is it? Height, weight, and speed is like the baseline for, okay, this kid has the requisite athleticism. Doesn't mean they're going to be a great football player, but that helps you eliminate players. It's a criteria is about elimination. There are slightly over a million high school players. Like, that's a large pool. Schools are trying to narrow down a set of players that have a baseline athletic ability. And yeah, it's important. I mean, we'll get into MPH afterwards, but historically, the 40 is used as kind of like, all right, we can eliminate these set of players. And you can, by looking at the numbers, be able to eliminate a majority of players, especially Division I and below, because there's such a small amount of high school players that even go to play Division III. So to answer your question, how important is it? Yes, it still is important, and a majority of schools are using it as a process of elimination, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in first parallel there, talking about the 40 is something that has stuck around because it's been around for so long, and there's so many data points on so many players. Like, that's why the 60 still exists in baseball, is because you can go back to, you know, you can comp a guy at a showcase today to someone from the 80s, and yeah, there's a lot of scouts out there that were scouting in the 80s that are still scouting today. So that's kind of funny. But yeah, I mean, in your opinion, and I do want to talk about the shift to MPH, right?
Yeah.
You know, you talked about, you know, why the 40s stuck around. Do you think it's antiquated? Do you think it's something that, you know, if you could just wipe the slate clean, the 40 wouldn't exist and you would, you know, kind of look at it in a different way?
Yeah, I think it's antiquated. I think in-game speed, now that we have technology player tracking, you know, and I'll share some resources with you guys to look at on player tracking. Ideally, if we're able to accurately measure like in-game speed, you know, I do think it's antiquated. It's stuck around because of the historical data, but we're starting to see MPH like creep in. We see players all the time, like, you know, Puka, the wide receiver from LA, and then Cooper Kupp, that didn't have blazing 40 times, but they are able to play within the context of a game as if they are running 4.4 speed. I mean, Cooper Kupp, there's just a lot of stimuli in a game that you have to respond to. And if you know how to control that speed in a game, you can play faster than what you run in a linear sprint. So yeah, I think it's antiquated. I think there are other ways to be able to measure athleticism that aren't being utilized. But again, we have that historical data. You have to begin to build up a historical data set, or to have, you know, I know you mentioned previously about comparing, that's normative data. The more and more historical data you have, like basically a you know, a bell curve where you can put guys in percentiles, and the larger that data set expands, the more you can kind of get some signal on where a guy actually compares historically to other players. But yes, to answer your question, I think it's antiquated. I think, you know, for the NFL, most teams, what you do is you look at those metrics, and it's just kind of, do we need to go back and confirm and go back to the tape? Did what we, because most of the evaluations for the draft are done, right? The guys come, they see these metrics, and either they say, hey, that 40 confirms what we saw on the tape, we don't need to see anything else, it goes into, you know, whatever database they have. Or it may have them stop and pause and say, he was a little bit slower with this 40 time, let's go back to the tape and see and confirm. But that's as far as I think the 40 now goes. I think it's, you know, it generates revenue and people like watching it on television. But sure, to answer your question, yeah, I think it's antiquated.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Well, and I think there's a parallel there between baseball and football, just in terms of some of the next gen stats, some of the stat cast up, is particularly with the advent of Hawkeye, which is really accurate in terms of, you know, how it picks up stuff versus TrackMan. It has the ability to look at sprint speed. So, you know, historically, we're behind home plate. We're watching amateur prospects. It's the home to first time that we're getting, right? Because we're not necessarily getting 60s unless it's a showcase event. I see a lot of college players. Well, the difference between like the top end sprint speed that you can measure with that technology versus the home to first, a guy can run a 4.5, which is a below average home to first time. But a guy like Aaron Judge, because he's bigger, because he's stronger, like you mentioned, you know, the athleticism, but also the size and the strength, his sprint speed is in the top, whatever, 2 percentile of all of baseball. And it's sort of similar where is it they're looking at sort of moments in games and just that explosiveness for a 5-yard run or a 6-yard run or a 7-yard out route or whatever. Is that how they're sort of picking that stuff up in a similar fashion to sprint speed? I'm just interested because I don't follow.
Yeah.
It's very unique,
right? By position. Let's take a couple of positions very quickly. Look at an edge rusher, right? Their first like 3 steps, that is probably as close to a sprinter. Like you look at Joey Bosa, look at a sprinter's stance and what an edge rusher looks like in a 3-point stance. That translates, in my opinion, for track and field. The first, like how quickly you can accelerate. And yes, there's some other things. You're moving around an object, which is different, but those first couple of steps are what we call get off or upfield burst. You know, there's a different ways you could say that. That's very important. Wide receiver might be the same thing, you know, very similar if you're facing somebody that's off man. But there's a lot of controlled game. You know, you have to have controlled speed. You're reading coverages at the same time and trying to maneuver within man and zone coverages. So there are some, you know, for example, that you look at a wide receiver and a defensive end, but then look at a corner, right? A corner is moving backwards. An offensive lineman is moving backwards, right? So there are certain contextual factors based on the position that you could say translate more towards the 40, especially if you're looking at splits, as opposed to other positions. You know, they don't, the 44, and we saw this at the combine. I don't care what an offensive lineman is running at a 40. You saw a lot of guys pull up with hamstring and quad issues. I don't know if you guys noticed that. That was a huge issue this year, where you have these guys that are 300 plus pounds who are running down, and a lot of them tweak their, you know, their hamstrings and quads. I don't, that is not translatable to me. The 10 yard split, you know, potentially yes, but you are moving backwards a majority of the time in the NFL. Yes, in the run game, you need to move forward, but we know it's a passing league now. So you're moving backward. So that's just an example of,
sure,
to me, that track and field or that 3-point start for the 40 is more important to look at for an edge rusher, somebody like a Joey Bosa or some of the other, every single edge rusher for that matter, mm-hmm, compared to an offensive lineman. Yeah. So
makes sense.
All right. So context dependent speed, if you will. Okay. So if you're going to lay out a battery of testing speed specifically by position, what would that look like? You know, you talked about how offensive linemen go backwards and defensive backs go backwards and whatever that, I mean, like how, if you were running the NFL combine and you wanted to get the information to the best of your understanding on these players by position group, like how would these different evaluations look?
Oh boy, we're gonna need some time for this. This is exciting, because if I was technically going to change the combine, I would do a number of things. Some things they're already doing. I posted this on Twitter, or X now, sorry. We're still calling it Twitter.
You can keep calling it Twitter. It's all right.
The NFL Combine now, when you are seeing all of the NFL Next Gen stats, and I posted this, most people don't know this. There's a company called Zebra Technologies. There are coin-shaped devices in the shoulder pads by Zebra Technologies, which is not GPS. There are kind of these kind of nodes throughout the stadium that are tracking the players real time. So that's how you get all of these awesome metrics like miles per hour, so on and so forth. They do that at the combine. If you notice the shoulder pads, and I was, Zebra Technologies confirmed it because they liked my tweet, and they don't have a lot of followers. People probably didn't even know what I was talking about. If you looked in the shoulders at the combine, they were tracking players throughout all of the drills and during the 40-yard dash. So I would be tracking MPH, or what is called max velocity, during the 40. They are already doing that. It's just not really made like public. We'll get into that later. But yes, I would track miles per hour during the 40. More importantly, how fast you can hit max velocity, how fast you can get fast, which is something that, you know, people don't understand. For a 40 yards, you're not running in a 40-yard straight line every single time. The NFL is about short bursts. The average play is 4 seconds or less. And for a running back, you're not running 40 yards for, you know, the average yards per, you know, gain for a running back is less than 5 yards. So I would look at time to how fast you can get hit max velocity and slash acceleration. That to me is a metric that I would make public. I think they're already looking at it, but it's just not made public. You guys just see the 40 times and the 10 yard splits, but they could give the MPH and make it public. They're already doing that. I would do what is called also instantaneous speed. Now, I'm going to explain this. You can get what is called average miles per hour or average velocity by looking at the splits. So if you do a 60 meters and you look at the 10, 20, 30, you can calculate through basic, you know, physics what the average velocity is. Instantaneous velocity, I'm going to use this example. You're driving your car, and that state trooper is aiming that laser gun there. There is a company called Muscle Lab that has a device called Laser Speed, where you are able to measure instantaneous velocity by setting up a laser behind the sprinter. You don't need to attach anything. and being able to track the miles per hour every single step. That is the difference between instantaneous real time at every step as the object moves, as opposed to average velocity. So I would add instantaneous velocity. I would also add what is called momentum. You added Aaron Judge. If a 300-pound lineman is running, you know, a 4.9 in the 40, that weight, you have to factor in weight. So I would add kind of like a momentum score. And we can do it with the NFL. They just don't make it public. They're already doing it. Everybody says, you know, take into consideration the parameters of the position, but you also have to look at weight. Like Derrick Henry, for example, he is a large human being. When he is running a 4.5, the momentum that you can calculate him at is completely different from a smaller running back that's 190 pounds. So I would calculate a momentum score. The next thing that I would add, which the NFL is already doing, but it's not made public because that doesn't generate revenue, is the usage of force plates. Force plates have been around for decades. You have Vald Performance, Hawken Dynamics, which is located, I believe, Maine. Force plates are a verified, like very different from the vertical jump, where you can add a number of different exercises in. And I'm not going to go into details with that, but I would definitely use force plates. I would use what's called a mid-thigh pull, where you hold onto a bar and you basically have your feet planted. They're already doing that at certain events, but it's just not made public. Hawken Dynamics was at the combine. They've been there for 3 years, and they're probably collecting a lot of historical data. The reach vertical, I would get rid of it. There's too many ways you can cheat the reach vertical. And I'll use an example. Like when you do the reach vertical, you have to basically put your hands up first, and players can cheat by hunching down a little bit. There's all different types of ways that you could, but everybody's like, a guy is, you know, has a 40-inch vertical. I would get rid of that. I don't think the NFL will, because of the historical data that they've collected over decades. But you're seeing that they have brought in Hawken Dynamics, and there was no mention of it on NFL Network. That data to me is going to be more valuable. Now, it's probably not going to be made available to the public, but they are, the NFL, they're doing things behind the scenes to be able to kind of catch up with technology to help with player profiling. So just a recap, I would do instantaneous velocity MPH with a laser. I would add that to the 40. You don't have to get rid of the 40, keep it. I would use the MPH data from Zebra Technologies, which they're already doing. But again, it's not what everybody is talking about on X. They're like the 40 time, the vertical, everything that the NFL puts out publicly, right? Mm-hmm. But they are doing this already. I would infuse force plates. I would also measure curve linear speed, right? How you move throughout an arc. The problem with that is technology. You can use timing gates for it, but Swift Performance, which is a company that's based in Australia, has a timing gate that can basically measure the miles per hour as you're moving throughout an arc. So imagine, you know, in the NFL combine, they do the hoop drill where the guys are running in circles, picking up the, you could be able to calculate curve linear speed. They can do that now with the coin-based RFID devices. I don't know, you know, I'd have to look at how accurate that is, but I would infuse curve linear drills to be able to measure how guys are moving in and out of breaks for wide receivers, you know, even for DBs as well. And those are kind of the things, again, I think everything else now with the player tracking that they're doing, it's just about, you know, using that data. I think teams are using that data more and more and more now. But those are the things that I would change, which I think the league is doing. But to you and I, or people that don't have access to the data, you just don't know what, how they're using the data, because it's not really made public.
Yeah, there's a ton to uncover there. I love
that. Yeah, I talk a lot, man. Sorry. I hope you guys are trying to explain.
But I love the idea that there's like an underground combine going on where they're looking at different data, the zebra chips, and then you know, talk about force plates. Force plates have become really popular in the past couple of years in baseball.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of teams that were on it a lot earlier than others, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, whatever it might be. But man, I don't even really know where to start. I think it's really interesting, you know, when you talk about instantaneous speed and momentum and those types of things. I don't know. And Jeff touched on it earlier. I don't know how familiar you are with Hawkeye and the StatCast data in baseball, but there's like these $600,000-$700,000 installs in these stadiums, and they're getting instantaneous speed, and they're tracking, you know, top velocity of runners in feet per second. So you can go on Baseball Savant and you can look up any player and you can see, you know, their percentiles in Major League Baseball for their top end running speed in feet per second, which is kind of cool. But, you know, talking about curvilinear speed, right? And that's something that's also important in baseball because, you know, you get first base, you turn left, get second base, turn left, right?
In the outfield too, right?
And in the outfield, I mean, you're very rarely running straight in baseball unless you're running a hard 90. But, you know, someone that I've been following for probably 2 or 3 years on Twitter is Bobby Stroop. He works with Pat Mahomes. I know you know who he is. And he also works with Bobby Witt Jr., who's one of the fastest guys on all Major League Baseball. Kansas City Royals just signed a big contract, probably going to be an early season MVP candidate here. So, but what I thought was really fascinating going back, I mean, maybe like a year ago, is, you know, there's a lot of like he tweets things sometimes and he gives you a peek under the hood that a lot of people probably don't fully grasp. But when you talked about curvilinear speed, you know, he had tweeted something probably a little over a year ago that Patrick's actually faster in a curvilinear pattern than he is just straight on. And, you know, it's something that they actively train. And then, you know, also talked about his sprint speed going backwards as a percentage of his sprint speed going forwards, and how he's much faster going backwards relative to the average player in the NFL going backwards relative to his speed going forward. So it was kind of interesting, you know, reading that thread whenever that was, and then thinking about, you know, Patrick Mahomes in the pocket, and it's like, well, you know, he's not going to burn anybody in a 40, but this guy's like trying to catch a ghost. You know, the way that he moves, changes directions, like all his moves are so tight. And I think that just kind of gets back to, you know, being able to measure, you know, that instantaneous speed, how fast you can get going in a certain direction. You know, and in his case, it's not always how fast can you get going straight. It's how fast can you get going in whatever direction I got to get going, because that's where the defensive lineman's coming from or the linebacker or whatever it might be. So I don't know. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to, I don't want to cut you off. One thing that just came to mind that I wanted to mention, another assessment I would use is what's called the acceleration-deceleration assessment. There's been plenty of research on this where, and you can actually measure this with an instantaneous laser where you have a guy run as fast as possible. There's a researcher, J.B. Morin, M-O-R-I-N, who did some very great research on being able to measure and calculate how a player decelerates, which is extremely important for wide receivers. That just came up. And I was like, as you were talking about, you know, Mahomes, it's all contextual, how you move specific to the position that you're playing. And being able to break or decelerate is very important in football, especially for certain positions. But that's another assessment that I thought of, the ADA assessment, where you have guys run a 20 meter sprint and see how quickly they can break. So yeah.
Yeah. Probably be a little bit more value in that than doing like a 5-10-5.
Yeah. Or yeah. 5-10-5. Yeah. We didn't even get into, I said the 40 was antiquated. The pro agility does not measure change of direction speed. Like it doesn't. People don't realize that. They're like, you hear it on NFL Network. Yeah, you can change direction. That actually does not measure your ability to be able to stop and break and then re-accelerate again. It's not the final number that you get. So it's like most sports scientists know this, but the way that these tests have kind of been sold to the public, that there's more to it than just the number, right? That's another discussion for another day. But and then the other thing is we call it the pro agility. It's not an agility drill. You have to have a stimulus, right? Agility is being able to react to another player or, you know, within soccer, whether it's football, whether it's basketball, to some other moving object that you need to be able to respond to. That makes it agility. You know, it's, we call it the pro agility drill. I don't know who named it that, but
right.
The 5-10-5, you know, it has its weaknesses, but you do have historical data, right? You know, Julian Edelman, I don't know if you guys know the story of this. He had one of the fastest when he was coming out. I think he had the fastest 5-10-5. It was either the 5-10-5 or the cone that really kind of pinged, yeah. You know, I'm sure Ernie, the great Ernie Adams, if you don't know him, for the Patriots. Ernie quietly, they put him in the Dynasty documentary. There he is. He should be in the Hall of Fame. He's been with Belichick for decades, went to school with Belichick. There should probably be a book written on Ernie Adams. And if I sit down and pick his brain, he could probably teach us a masterclass. He probably won't because Belichick is very guarded in their methodology. But you want to talk about who helped Belichick be able to build those rosters? Ernie Adams. I'm glad they had him in the Dynasty, you know, series that they put out on Apple. And most people don't know what he does. But let me tell you something. That man knows more about player profiling than he's probably forgotten, you know, more than I ever will in a lifetime.
Sure. This is more of a personal question, actually, because it's a conversation I've had with people about Ernie Adams in terms of like how progressive they were in factoring some of this stuff into their evaluations and thinking outside the box. The feedback I'd always gotten from people who had been inside the organization is that like Adams was doing things that other people weren't. And that's really what pushed the program forward. What type of stuff was Adams working on? I mean, do you even have any sort of insight into that?
Man, it's all speculation. I mean, it seems I will say this. But historically, and most people don't know this, Phil Savage, who is a mentor of mine, who is now at the Jets, he's a senior advisor, wrote a book called Fourth and Goal Every Day. Buy it and read it. If you don't like it, I promise you, I'll pay the cost of it. That's how he gave away some gems historically. Back in the 1970s, it was really the Dallas Cowboys with Gil Brandt who started looking at height, weight, and speed and player profiling. That's how they were able to build those dynasties. And they had these algorithms, you know, and none of this stuff is public. I mean, we would have to talk to Gil Brandt and get some firsthand information. Any information that I have is through things that I've read. But fast forward, Brandt in the early 90s, remember when Belichick and Saban were at Cleveland? Brandt, and this is documented in Savage's book because Phil was there with the Browns in his career, I think as a he was like an assistant.
He was on that 30 for 30, actually, that they did on that Cleveland staff.
Yeah, he was on that staff, and he documented and was able to discuss how Brandt passed that on to Belichick. And then when Belichick went on, you know, Ernie Adams was always doing analytical stuff, but to give you an answer, we really don't know. I mean, because these teams definitely are using technology in ways that are not made public, right? It's probably very guarded, and I'm sure they had something that they were doing to be able to profile these athletes. But Adams was legendary for being able to look at a stack of 500 players and be able to pull out that one player that you're like, it could have been a Matthew Slater or those, not necessarily the top guys.
Yeah.
Building a roster, you need to build it from top to bottom. And I wish I knew. I would love, you know, if these guys ever came out and actually shared some of the things that they do in terms of player profiling, what type of technology they're doing to be able to predict. You know, predictive analytics is huge now. Baseball, I've been doing it far. You know, I haven't said that yet. Baseball was doing this stuff way before the NFL started, you know, doing it. But to answer your question, I don't know. You know, I wish, you know, I'm sure Adams is retired right now and lives somewhere in the, you know, Massachusetts or something. Man, who knows? It. But let me tell you something. If I had months, I'd go up and just spend 8 hours with him a day because he just has had decades of experience.
Yeah.
And was probably in a room that was probably a dark area in the Patriots facility that nobody knew anything about. I wouldn't share those secrets.
No windows. It was in the bowels of Gillette Stadium, from my understanding. Yes.
Maybe he writes a book one day and this stuff comes to life. Maybe when Belichick retires, you know, I don't know if you've ever read Belichick's dad wrote a book called Football Scouting Methods, which was published. Yeah. I read, that was probably one of the first books I read. And that was in the early stages of, and you're reading it and you're like, wow, imagine the stuff that they're doing in the Patriots facility that maybe somebody knows. I'm sure somebody, if you know somebody that worked in there, could be able to give you some information. But you, the NFL is very guarded with, you know, what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, going back to earlier in the conversation, you were talking about Puka, and I saw the tweet with the relative athlete score and how it wasn't particularly good. And, you know, you talked about Cooper Kupp and all that. But I'm sure Tom Brady has, you know, a fair amount to say about this. But, you know, like over the years, Deion Branch and, you know, Chris Hogan, Danny Amendola, Julian Edelman, Wes Welker, like it just goes on and on where it's like, okay, these aren't the guys that are your traditional 40 burners. And they became really, really good in the context of the game, getting open, getting into those small spaces, operating in those small spaces, receiving the ball, making plays, right? And then you even think about some of the pass catching backs, right? Going all the way back, Kevin Falk, Patrick Pass, but then, you know, Danny Woodhead for a handful of years. And then, you know, most recently, James White, you know, and to your point, being able to identify that James White, I mean, I'm not sure anybody would have said James White was going to be a better NFL back than Monty Ball out of that same backfield. And, you know, James White ends up being an all-time Patriots great. Monty Ball, I don't know if he made it 3 or 4 years in the league. So, I definitely think that, you know, it's to go to kind of wrap a bow on Ernie Adams. If you could go have dinner with anybody dead or alive right now, I think Ernie Adams is sneakily is dark horse on that list.
Yep. Or going out to Nantucket and just spending the summer with Belichick as he, you know, I lived on Martha's Vineyard during the summers and had seen him. I would go over to Nantucket and have some stories where, you know, I would see Belichick like riding his bike. And I'm not the type of person when I see celebrities where I go up to them. And man, I'm just thinking, maybe I should just go up and start talking about history. And, you know, because Belichick is a huge historian. And I'm sure he probably gets approached a lot, you know, from fans talking about questions that are just like, you know, he's like, that are elementary that he doesn't want to discuss. But I'll tell you, those are him and Saban. I would sit down and talk to them for hours, and they could probably teach a masterclass on just player evaluation and just football in general. But, you know, we can only hope.
All right. So before we wrap this thing up, and then we'll let you kind of get going with your day. Well, we have to ask you about sandwiches because you are a New York guy and your opinion does matter on that. But
hold serious weight. We've had a lot of Southerners on here and I'm just like, all right. Yeah. We're not asking about chicken biscuits.
Yeah, we're not asking about chicken biscuits. But talk a little bit about your process currently with your events that you run. And you said recently that, you know, well, the past couple of years, you've become a practitioner in timing. The system that you use, how you do it. I know you factor in the wind. I want you to talk a little bit about that. And then I kind of want you to juxtapose that against the information that's also currently available at a lot of like football, high school combine type events, right? And like how they're doing it versus how you're doing it. Because, and I'll just, you know, again, throw this out front. Like, there was a player a handful of years ago who ran a 5.58 60-yard dash at a Perfect Game National Showcase, which is the big national showcase. And I went on this thing like for like 2 months trying to figure out, like, okay, well, what was it? All right. I wasn't just like content with like the way they had the timing gate set up. Okay, maybe it was at 58 yards and it wasn't at 60 yards. Right. Because this guy was also like one of the top track runners in the state of North Carolina. And his best time in the 55 meter, which is roughly 60 yards, was like a 6.22, 6.23. I'm like, there's no way he's shaving, you know, over 0.2 of a second off. That's just not possible. Right. But they're over here, you know, broadcasting. This is the fastest guy who's ever run the 60 at our event. And it's a sub six. And it's like, when you really do the conversion on it, it's ridiculous. He's the fastest man on earth, basically. And ultimately what it came down to was procedure. Right. And when I was doing some testing my own with some athletes, I'm always very cognizant of, okay, we're going to set up, I put down a piece of duct tape right at the start. And it's like the right foot goes up against the tape, not on the tape, not behind the tape, right up against it. So you can see the whole tape, but you can't see anything in between. Right. And everything is consistent every time from like, okay, I'm going to count down 3, 2, 1, go. Anytime after go, go. Right. Because I've seen over the years, there's so many different ways that you can mess it up and guys can get bad starts and this, that, and whatever. And it's like, I just want one good bolt and I want it to be consistent. Right. So I'm testing a group of like 15 or 16 year olds and I map the whole thing out. I got them all standing in front of me. I map the whole thing out. This is how we're going to do it. And the first like 7 guys go and they'll do it. Right foot right up against the tape. Wait for me to go. 3, 2, 1, go. And then there's that one space cadet who's never paying attention. And he gets up and he sets up about that far behind the tape. All right. So like maybe 5, 6 inches. And he puts his head down and he doesn't wait for me and he just goes. And his 10-yard split was like 0.2 of a second faster than anybody else that day. And I had already run like 150 kids. So when he came back, I was like, okay, you're going to have to go again. I wait for him to catch his breath. Foot up against the tape. Ready, go. And then sure enough, it's basically just add 0.2 of a second. But I was sitting there, I was like, procedure is so important because there's so many like old school scouts at like the Perfect Game events that are just like, ah, you can't trust lasers. And it's like, that's the most backwards thing that you could say, because like you're over here using a stopwatch and like you can trust a laser. The procedure is the context that isn't good. Anyway. I'm going to let you go here because I know that this is a topic that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm going to try to condense everything and be as like concise as possible. Cause we probably could talk about this for a while. Protocols and procedures are the most important thing. Even if you look at track, I always go back to track and field. If you look at the protocols and procedures for Olympic timing, it's like pages, everything down to your spike length. They even have everything is about controlled protocols, just like an experiment. I go back to sixth and seventh grade and you need to be able to, if you want to be able to trust your data, have protocols that are consistent. And you have to make sure that you minimize contextual factors that can influence time, right? With a sprint like the 40, just like you said, and I don't even need to explain it because you gave an example of the tape and the foot, you were able to get 0.2 of a second just by one subtle foot placement, right? You know, if you move or do what's called, that's a, you know, he left before, you know, before the stimulus of going. So protocols and procedures are important. Why? Because the slightest change in any external factor can influence time. And the shorter the distance, the more important the protocols and procedures. Look at the 60 meter world indoor championship difference between Noah Lyles and Kristen Coleman. It was 0.1 of a second. It was like 6.43, it was 6.42 was first place, 6.43 was second place. You can't stand there with a stopwatch. I always say this when they say, People say timing gates are not accurate. Then how come the Olympics doesn't have nine people sitting there with stopwatches going? Can you imagine the chaos? You would never be able to have integrity in the times. The reason why track and field is kind of the standard that we all should be looking at is because you have all of these events happening globally, right? Who can have a world record if you have in the U.S., they have their Olympic trials, right? And then in the UK, they have it. The reason why the Olympics is kind of where we need to be looking when we're talking about player profiling for baseball and football is because they have universal standards. And if one mm-hmm. of those standards is not in place, like I'm going to use an example. There was a indoor 400 meter record. There was a guy in college, this happened recently, that his world record was not confirmed because the pressure sensor on the actual starting blocks was not functioning. So they couldn't verify it. Now, it doesn't neglect his time at all, but for a world record, that one like protocol that needed to be in place to be able to confirm the world record was not working. And that way you have integrity of the sport. And I start with that because that's going to segue into the times and it being the Wild West with these high school combines. And I'll talk about my processes and procedures. Everything for me as a American football, and I always say American football because we know globally my soccer, as we call it here, they always get on to me. He's like, it's not, my friends say it's not football. In American football, the NFL combine is where we need to look at contextually because all of that data drives the star system for 247 Sports, On Three, and these recruiting service. They get that data and that drives what the profile looks like for a five-star. So let's look at the NFL combine, the contextual factors, and where I think all evaluators that are collecting high school times or metrics need to do. It's inside, right? When you are inside, temperature and wind can impact. You want control conditions, right? So that's the first thing that I always attempt to do. You sometimes need to do things outside, and I'll talk about that in a minute. You need to be running on turf, right? If I'm running on a Mondo track surface at the Armory, I'm going to be able to run faster, slightly faster as opposed to a turf, running on a turf. So the surface you want consistent on a turf, similar to the NFL combine, inside because you have controlled temperature and you don't have wind, right? In track and field, you have a wind gauge, right? If you're outside, so you have a wind legal time. The wind legal time where you have for example, with wind, you can have a headwind, which is coming into you, which will slow you down if it, you're running into a pretty heavy wind, or you can have tailwind. The reason why they have those rules for track and field is to make sure that there's integrity, right? So if you have a tailwind of 2.0 meters per second or greater, that is not a wind legal time, right? You have to have it below that. And then that can confirm whether or not you have a world record or not. So if I'm outside, I will use a wind gauge. So that way I have context. So if a kid runs a crappy time and that wind gust was there and we measured it, I have that context to be able to explain the time, right? You were able to explain the difference between that 2/10 of a second by the foot placement. Now let's go to the start. The start is crucial. 3-point start is what we obviously do because that's similar to the NFL, right? We want the times to be different. You can do a standing 2-point start, but a 3-point start. And then what starts the actual time? The way that you explained it, 3-2-1 go, that is a stimulus, the sound that they hear, and then they go. In the NFL, there are three ways that they do timing, and then I'll talk about the ways that I do it in a second. They have a gentleman that's sitting in front of the table that has a push button that pushes the button, and that starts the clock, and that's based on movement. There's a laser at the end that calculates the stop time. There is also a photocell beam. If you guys were looking, and I said this on, if you go back and you look at the combine, there are two like red blocks there. When they put their hand down, the gate is armed. When they lift that hand, that is when the clock starts. So that's the second time that they have. And then the last one is old school. As you are saying, you got this, the teams will calculate those times with a stopwatch. So there are three different, and they have the MPH times too, which nobody is going to see because right. the chips are there. So it's actually four. The way that I do it is very similar to the NFL combine, where I have a gate at the start, and it will either be a like thumb pad release that the player will push down when they have their down hand, and when they go, that will trigger the start. And then there will be a gate at the 40. Now I use there's a company called Vald that does what's called error protection processing, and it was big in baseball. Vald, the gates that Vald has, the technology, it used to be Fusion Sport. Fusion Sport no longer does that. They used to do a lot of baseball combines, but they have a technology called error protection processing. And what that does is that, imagine you guys are running, right? And your hand strikes the gate before your torso, right? You have what's called a leading hand striking it. That can happen when you have a single beam. In order to get more accuracy, to be able to stop the time at the torso, you can have either a dual beam where you have two beams there and they both need to be impeded to stop the time. Or you can have a single beam with error protection, error correction processing. Sorry. What that does is it literally looks for the largest time period. And I'll share a graphic of this, that a hand crossing the beam is not going to trigger it. It's going to look for the longest duration that the beam is being blocked and calculate the time based off of that. So the torso is going to be the widest part of the body. So once you go through, it will look and look at that first, you know, if a hand triggered it, and then it'll look at the longest duration, and then it'll calculate the final time. I do that. I use error protection, correction processing, because I use Bald's gates to get me the times. I also have an instantaneous laser that is separate, that is at pointing at the back of the sprinter, where I can calculate max velocity, and I use the Muscle Lab laser speed. So I have two individual timing systems going at once, and I'm calculating data that way, and I can get splits, so on and so forth. When I am outside, I use a wind gauge there, so that way I have some additional data, so that if a kid does run, you know, is off for some reason, I have some contextual information to be able to explain that. Let's say it was like 98 degrees with humidity, or it was like raining at the time. A lot of the camps that are done outside, like, I'm always like, what time of year is it? And what was the temperature? So on and so forth. When that's not provided, that hurts the player, in my opinion, because there are contextual factors. Like, you didn't take the SAT, you know, in Boston in the middle of January, sitting at a desk outside. Like, I say that because look at the way that we do standardized tests. The same thing. You are essentially doing an experiment where you want to control all of the factors that can influence the time, and then try to make sure it's as close as possible to the NFL. You know, there's a lot that the NFL doesn't do well. So that's how I time the 40. I do some other, you know, measurements, like for a broad jump. I don't know if this is big in baseball. I, you know, a lot of people use those kind of like mats that lay out the distances. Those are problematic because they can have folds and crinkles in it. I use a broad jump mat, actually, that the player stands on, so they jump on it, so I can move that anywhere. I don't like the measuring tape. Some people do it because they have to if they're scouts, but I like having a trustworthy product where I can, you know, where I can accurately measure the broad. So that's kind of a summation. Like, I just talked about the 40, and I could talk about this for 2 or 3 hours with the other kind of assessments that we do, but that is my timing setup. Now, here's the last thing I'm going to add that is a huge problem. How do you know the distance? If you are on a track, right? Those tracks are already, if they are approved tracks, the times are already there. So if you go to your high school track, right, or local track, You can measure the 100 meters already there. But if you walk into a facility that you've rented, how do you ensure that if you're measuring a 60 meter, that it's actually 60 meters? There have been stories, I won't get into them, where there's people that cheat and move the gate up half a foot. You know, kid gets a faster time. That's where protocols and who's policing the people that are not, I'm not going to say policing, who is there to double check, like at a track meet, if you guys go to the New Balance facility, they have cross checks for everything to make sure there's integrity in the times and nobody is trying to speed up the times, right? If let's say I'm a combine organizer and I have a history of my times being faster, kids may want to sign up at my camp, but I'm cheating the entire process because my protocols are we're not doing things with integrity. Mm-hmm. But lastly, I'll say this about the measuring, and I'm going to give you guys a kind of tool. Laser distance meters, there's a company called Leica, L-E-I-C-A. I tell combine organizers, and this can be used in baseball and football, if you go into a facility and you want a validated instrument that has been cross-checked and has a, you know, approval process for accuracy, and that's one thing that track and field does, and I'll get back to the laser distance meter because this is important. Every single device, like when the Olympics, the USATF guidelines, if there is a fully automated timing system, it has to be independently validated, meaning the machine needs to be checked within 4 years for it to be able to be approved for a sanctioned meet, right? So sometimes the equipment cannot work. Now, I say all of this because let's look at go back to the laser distance meter. There is just a laser beam that you literally will align and you'll have a target plate. This is how they measure things like in the Olympics. You'll see them standing there looking for like the shot put and stuff. It ain't just, you know, Joe Smith going out there being like, oh, here goes the measuring tape. You got a world record on the line. They have these laser distance meters that basically will accurately calculate the distance that the object was thrown. But for the 60 meters and the 40, for the 40, I use a approved laser distance meter. So if I'm in a facility that doesn't have yard lines, I will check that with that. And it's accurate down to like 1/16 of an inch. So that way I'm not giving, you know, a couple inches, because inches matter. So that's another like proto. Nobody else does it. Nobody uses a wind gauge. Like nobody uses a wind gauge.
Yeah.
Nobody.
When I saw you tweet about a wind gauge, I was like,
it's less than four. But guys, it's less than $400. It's like, you know, people always they'll come at me at Twitter. Well, what does that really matter? Like, don't you want your data to be as accurate as possible and take pride in it? You know, there's a difference. People want to make money off of the events, right? Like, take pride in spend the money to make sure that when a kid does leave, they have the most accurate data as possible. That's just like ethics, right? You know, I was the kid in seventh grade that wanted to get the experiment and follow it exactly how my science teacher did it, because I wanted my results to be as accurate as possible. You learn about that in like sixth, seventh grade science, like making sure your experiment can be repeated. But yet I got grown adults that are like, I'm not buying a wind gauge or whatever. And I'm just kind of like, yo, there's scholarships on the line. If my time is going to be used and a kid is going to use it to get a scholarship, I owe it to that kid, one who's paying to be at the event, to spend the money to have tools that are going to allow my data to be as accurate as possible. And I'll stop there, because I told you there's a lot of layers and like, you know, to like this process. And the same thing is applicable to baseball. You know, I'm sure I probably listed a bunch of things that you're like, they don't do this, they don't do that. Laser distance meter, I'll share it like on Twitter. Get it. They're very easy. You can get a decent one for under $200, a target plate. You line it up and then you just cross-check it. And then being prepared ahead of time. I'll end on this. Don't walk into a combine. I never walk into a facility and in 5 minutes I need to be set up. I'm there an hour and a half in advance. doing all of the measurements, having people cross check like what I did. Let's check this again. So I measure it out, whether or not I use a kind of spray can to measure out the start. I'm going to check it 30 minutes later. And just, it's all about having, write down your protocols and procedures, which is what I do. And then I will check them multiple times over and over, and then look at your data, right? You did that 0.2 seconds because that kid's foot was back. You clearly are thinking like a scientist, which we all should be doing, and looking like, that's not right, right? You know, if I look at Christian Coleman or Noah Lyles, they're not going to have a huge difference. Like, you should have, if you want your data to be accurate and reliable, there really should not be a huge gap between times 1 and 2. If there is, there was a difference in the protocols, right? And you have to look at that and have the guy run it another time as opposed to 1 or 2 times. So that's it. I know I rambled for a lot, man. When you guys wanted me to come on, you know, I came in, that, you know, you didn't get paid for the engagement, but if I did, you got your money's worth for it. And I, I'm always happy to talk about this stuff because people do not pay as much attention to it. And even though it's baseball, some of the things that you mentioned, Matt, that people don't talk about them at all.
Yeah, and we can subtitle this one Brian Hawkins' Attention to Detail. And I really do appreciate you going as deep as you did there on all that, and I really appreciate your whole process. And again, that's part of the reason why I wanted you have you come on here and kind of talk through it.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, you know, go back 7-8 years, and not going to call anybody out by name, but large showcase company in the amateur space here, and like, you know, I was working for USA Baseball. And we had, you know, the best pitchers in the draft class, the high school draft class, at our complex for a week for the Tournament of Stars. And, you know, most of the pitchers there are 88, 90, right? And it's on the TrackMan unit, which is, you know, the standard for measuring fastball velocity and pitch metrics and all that. And 88 to 90 over 2 to 3 innings, whatever it is. And then without fail, it was the second year in a row that this happened. The next week was the big showcase, and they went to the big showcase, and everyone was 90, 92. And I was sitting here, I was like, why are they 2 miles per hour faster on average in the same length of outing 1 week later, right? Like, all these guys are throwing harder at this event. And I was able to get my hands on a couple of their baseballs, which are, you know, it's that showcase company's branded baseball. And I went to the post office and I weighed them. And they, one, they had flatter seams, and two, they were 0.1 ounce lighter. And I was like, oh, it makes sense, right? So that goes back to what you were saying, where it's like, okay, showcase companies maybe in football where, you know, come to our events, you'll run the fastest 40s. And that will get a lot of people to sign up and come to that event, you know?
And people, it's not fair to the other kids
where you throw the hardest, you know?
Yeah. It's not fair to the other kids, because if that data is being used by colleges because another event modified something like that, you know, you got to have integrity in it. You can't take the data seriously. And you have to look for those things, but it's not fair to other kids that are maybe in another part of the country that were throwing at 88 using TrackMan, which is an incredible piece of technology, by the way. But yeah, like, you're right. That's not fair. Like, your data is not, you create a lot of noise in your data, right? And everything is about protocols and ensuring that you follow them, and that when you look at all of those miles per hours with TrackMan, just look at 10 years worth of data, you're going to put an asterisk next to that one where you're like, you know, this was not consistent. And I'm sure as you went to other events, if that was kind of the average between that 88 miles per hour range, you'll see that. And then the organizers should say, hey, there was a problem with this, right? We really can't use this data. And then you gotta be honest with the kids, like, hey, you threw 92, but on average, through using this tool, it was probably about like an 88, you know. But that's incredible, man, that you have that much integrity to go, you know, weigh the ball. You know, I give you a lot of credit, man. It's like, everybody should be like,
if it's just curiosity, you know. I think it's trying to identify what all those variables are, just like you are with the sprinting stuff, because ultimately that's how you're going to get the clearest picture of what you're looking at, right? You know, at the very least, it's like, shame on them for having a lighter baseball. But like, I know with confidence now that if they're throwing a little bit harder at those events, that it's because of the baseball. So when they go back to, you know, if they get drafted, they go play pro ball or go play college baseball and the velocity ticks back down one or two notches, it's like, oh, that explains it. You know, yep. He's not hurt. He didn't go backwards. Like, that's just what he is, you know?
Yeah. And you've learned through just practice, and there'll probably be things that I notice that if you are an observant, like, scientist, those are the things you're identifying. You're part of that as a timer or as a combine organizer. You are essentially collecting data. What do good scientists do? You know, this is sixth, seventh grade. You have a hypothesis, you create protocols, you test, and then you look at your results and you challenge your results, right? And that's essentially what it is. And you don't need to have a PhD or a doctorate in sports scientists. You can have other people crunch your numbers. But as a practitioner that is actually a tester out there conducting the experiment, which is totally different from analyzing the data afterwards, those are the questions that people need to ask with looking and questioning their data, right? And if you screwed up and there's a protocol that influenced the time, you need to know that so you can you can correct it, because that's how you get credibility in this space. And there are a lot for that company that you just said, if they're a big company, I'm not going to work. That's why I work, like, I run and control everything, because if I worked for a company and I came to them and I said, that ain't right, but they're selling data, especially in football, is big dollars, like tens of thousands of dollars of data is being sold for, you know, underclassmen report, which Tom Luganbill works for, and they do the Under Armour camps. That data is being sold for big money to the 64 out of 65 Power Five programs. If I'm working for that company, and something like that happens and I bring it up and it's not changed, money can make people do things, right? If that's going to hurt the bottom line, are they going to change it or admit to it or not? And that's why I'm like, I would never do that. Like, I run it my camps, like, my way with integrity. And I have to have people check me as well, to be like, Brian, that might not be right, because I might have blind spots that I'm not seeing. That's why I separated. Another thing I did was separate my combine from like the on-field portion. I don't do it on the same day because I think it's too much, like, for the players. But, you know, you hit the nail on the head. You have to question your data and be constantly looking at it, especially as you're accumulating this massive data set. And you'll see the trends, like 2/10 of a second between the first time and the second time. And it was all because of a foot. Like, you gotta approach it that way. Some people do it and they have that mentality where they really want to be like, pay attention to all of the details, and others are kind of like nonchalant, like, well, that's the time, you know, whatever, instead of questioning the data. Clean data collection should be our goals no matter what, especially if you're telling a parent where they fall, right, with baseball. Hey, here's where you fall, you know, in terms of the percentile. But if you don't have your protocols and procedures set up, that throws it completely out the window, right?
You know, and I do think that the attention to detail, you know, that you express and that I express, and Jeff has his own attention to detail in what he does. We'll give him some credit too. You know, I like to credit. Yeah, it's like a life thing, right? And yep. I like to credit my dad and my grandpa for it, because you could clearly see where it comes from and how they apply their attention to detail in their lives. But yeah, I don't want to take any more of your time outside of the sandwich question.
Go ahead, man. I know we went on. Sorry, I went off.
Not at all. That was the good information.
I do want to applaud you on separating the combine portion from the on-field portion of your events, because that's another thing, right? Workload. Completely different discussion. We could go down that rabbit hole another time. We
definitely could. All right. Yeah. What's the sandwich question?
All right. So we're going to be on the baseball scouting scale here. 20/80, 50s average. It's a bell curve. All right. So 80 is going to be 3 standard deviations that way, 20s, 3 standard deviations that way.
Okay. All the famer and a non-prospect.
Yeah. So we got four sandwich spots, and you got to pro scouting grades on them. Jimmy John's, Subway, the famous Jersey Michaels, and Capriati's.
Hold on. All right. So Jimmy John's, and then go ahead. What were the other three?
Subway. Jersey Michaels.
Jersey Mike's.
Yep. And Capriati's.
All right. Hold on.
What's Capriati's? Say it.
Okay. So the only three that I can speak on are Jimmy John's, Subway, and Jersey Mike's. Capriati's, I think I've had it before, but I would probably only be able to, honestly, with integrity right here, since this topic was about timing and integrity and being honest, I can score. Subway is like last percentile, man. Like, I don't put that at the lowest. Like, that was like the no-brainer right there. Like, how can you compare, like, Jersey Mike's compared to Subway? You can't even compare that at all. Jersey Mike's, if I'm going to, between Jersey Mike's, so what did I say? Subway, what were the percentiles again? Like 20th and what else?
It's 20, 30, 40, 80. 40, 20, 30, 40, 50 is average.
20 to 80.
60, 20, 70, 80.
All right, so in 10 increments from 20 to 80. All right, so Subway is immediately in the 20th percentile. Like, whoever goes with those options alone, you should be shot dead if you even put that. They shouldn't even be in the category like that. 20th percentile. I would say Jersey Mike's is going to be in like the, I would put it, see, it all depends on where you go. This is a trick question. When you have chained food places, some are better than others. The ones that I've gone to, and I've been to one like around the Newark area, I'm going to give that a 60th percentile. And the reason why is that it was the person that runs the Jersey Mike's. Remember, not all chains are the same. Some places have differences. So, if you do disagree, it's probably because of the experience that you had with going to it. And then Jimmy John's, I had a really good experience. I'm going to put that at like, from ranking them. Can I have a tie for them? Or have to rank like 1 through 4?
You can give them the same grade.
I'm going to put 60% for that one as well. So Subway gets a 20%, and then I'm going to put 60 and 60 for Jimmy John's and Jersey Mike's, only based on the experience of what I've gone to with the specific place that I've gone to. And then with Capriati's, man, I would have to come back to that. I would assume through Capriati's that would be the highest percentile, because I know people that have gone there before. I know all four of these places. But I don't want to put, if I haven't actually eaten the food or remember that I've eaten the food, because I've been to the other, I don't even go to Subway's anymore. But I would assume, based on what I've been told, that it would probably be in a higher percentile, like a 70 to 80%, based on what I've been told. But I would have to go. You guys should have told me to go to all these places beforehand. And then I would have had all of my notes. You know,
nobody's ever eaten Capriati's. I went there.
Yeah, I'm like,
they had one at Gillette, and then they closed it. Like, I went to go the second time. I told Matt, and I was like,
wasn't it on that? It was at Gillette on that Patriot Way. That's where I remember it, and I was like, that's when I ate there. That was the last time I ate there. Was at a Patriot game, or it might have been a college game, and Patriot Way was open. That was actually the last time that I had eaten there. But I was like, that had been a while ago. So that's probably, well, it's good to know that I didn't fail the test. No. I would have had to go on all the way up there and then eaten there and then came back. I would have been like, listen, I would have taken pictures of the food and wrote down exactly what I was experiencing while I was eating it. But
this might be the first guy to have Jersey Mike's in Jersey.
Yeah. I live right. There's no Jersey Mike's in I haven't seen one in New York. Like, I live right outside the Bronx. They'd probably kick them out. It's Jersey on it. Like,
you got five or six probably like upper echelon sandwich places within 3 miles of where you live.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, there's
in the Jersey motherland, Mike's. My favorite, the 80 on the scale for me is DeFonte's in Red Hook, Brooklyn. That's the
I've heard of that.
The best sandwich place in New York. Yep. Like when I'm in Brooklyn in May, the first thing I'm doing before I go to the park is I'm driving there. I'm getting myself a sandwich. And then I'm driving back to Coney Island. I'm sitting in the press box and I'm going to sit there and eat it and piss off the scouts. And they'll be like, you going to go there tomorrow? I'll be like, yeah, you want a sandwich? As we did last year. We had 3 days in a row where like me and two other scouts were making runs to DeFonte's and would come back with the order. Exactly. Wow. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Man. All right. Well, I hope I did well on like the precise. I was honest, you know, didn't come on. But yeah,
so as long as you nail Subway. As long as you nail Subway, you're doing good, and you nailed Subway.
Yeah, that's like if somebody puts them anywhere near the 50th percentile with comparing those, they need to have their right to have an opinion revoked. I would have been like, I would immediately stop them and said, no, this data is invalid. It's not accurate. Subway. No, there's no way, man.
Yeah, you thought you were having Subway. That was Capriati's wrapped in a Subway wrapper.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't even compare. All right. Well, yeah, at least I had three out of the four. But yeah, Capriati's, I haven't eaten there since like years. But I knew that Patriot Way had that spot was there. So
yeah, you got to find yourself some Capriati's.
There you go. No, no one's going to find it, Matt. They didn't sponsor us. It's not going to happen. But that being said, I want to wrap this up. I want to thank Brian Hawkins, Coach Hawkins. You can find him on Twitter at Brian Hawkins, or he is the Next Gen Prospect National Scouting Director. Appreciate you coming on and blessing us with a lot of insight. This was one of the better episodes I think we've had, and dive into a lot of interesting topics that have some crossover into multiple sports, not just baseball, not just football. We talked some track and field and just
some
athleticism. Good stuff. Thanks for coming on, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks, Hawk.
Thanks, man. Thank you guys so much. Have a good one.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.